This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. While writing a book about systemic racial inequality in Chicago public schools, my guest Eve L. Ewing did a lot of research into the history of segregation in Chicago. One of the most helpful documents she read was a report published in 1922 titled The Negro in Chicago, A Study on Race Relations and a Race Riot. It was written by 6 black men and 6 white men who were asked to research the reasons behind the riots in Chicago in July 1919 and to make recommendations about how to prevent them from happening again. The 1919 riots started after a 17-year-old black youth was swimming in Lake Michigan and swam into a part of the lake that was considered for whites only. He was stoned by white people and drowned. Black people on the black part of the beach demanded that a police officer arrest the person considered responsible, and he refused. Ewing's book, 1919, is a series of poems in response to the report. Most of the poems open with a quote from the report. Her book won this year's Best Poetry Book Award from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. Ewing is also a sociologist who teaches classes on race and education at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, where she's an assistant professor. Her books include Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Closings on Chicago's South Side. She also writes the Champion series for Marvel Comics and previously wrote the Ironheart series. We're going to start by talking about her book of poems, 1919. Eve Ewing, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start with your book of poems, 1919. It seems so relevant to today. You know, we all say if you want to understand what's happening now, you have to understand history. This is a really interesting part of that history that very few people know about, I think. So the book of poems is inspired by the report that was commissioned after the riots in 1919. It was a commission of 6 black men and 6 white men who were tasked with analyzing what happened during the riots, why it happened, and to make recommendations from preventing that from happening again. Before we get to what precipitated this uprising, let's talk about the opening quote that you use in the book, which is a quote from the introduction to the report. And that quote is, "The report contains recommendations which, if acted upon, will make impossible, in my opinion, a repetition of the appalling tragedy which brought disgrace to Chicago in July of 1919." What do you think about when you read that quote?
Well, the most obvious thing that comes to mind is the many repetitions of these appalling tragedies that we've seen since the report was written. And I think part of what I wanted to do in juxtaposing this text from 1922 with poems and inviting kind of an analysis from the reader is that there are so many things from a century ago that are radically different, and it seems that there are far many more things that are resoundingly familiar and frighteningly the same. And so, you know, so much of what the book is about the ways that time kind of folds in on itself. And unfortunately, we didn't follow the recommendations in that report 100 years ago. And Chicago, in many ways, doesn't look that different in 2020 as it did in 1919.
What were the recommendations in that report?
It's funny, there are recommendations that would look really familiar to you in a report that somebody might put out now. So things like, we need to make sure that black people in Chicago have access to affordable and high quality housing. We need to make sure that black people in Chicago have access to excellent schools and that they can get great teachers. We need to make sure that people have a fair shot at getting the same jobs as their white neighbors. We need to make sure that black people can safely use parks and pools and public facilities. It's discouraging to read the recommendations you would read now being issued a century ago and knowing with the benefit of hindsight everything that's happened since.
So I want to read another paragraph from the introduction to this report, and I think it shows the perspective of 100 years ago that these people who were writing the report were looking at the issue of race. And they're trying to contend with, like, there's all these people who moved to Chicago during the Great Migration. A lot of white people, like, don't want them there. You know, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with the issue of race and that black people were brought here as slaves? So they write, countless schemes have been proposed for solving or dismissing this problem, most of them impractical or impossible. Of this class, such proposals as, 1, the deportation of 12 million Negroes to Africa, 2, the establishment of a separate Negro state in the U.S., 3, complete separation and segregation from the whites and the establishment of a caste system or peasant class, and 4, hope for a solution through the dying out of the Negro race. Now, the people who wrote this report later say it is now recognized generally that the two races are here in America to stay. So 100 years ago, they're still addressing the issue of, like, What do we do? What do we do with these black people?
Right. What do we do? And by the way, that, you know, the premise of that entire quote also rests on the erasure of indigenous people, right? So even the framing of the two races is kind of predicated on that eradication. And so, yeah, it's really disturbing. And I think one thing I want to, you know, make clear is that the folks writing this report see themselves as kind of upstanding. Other people see them as kind of upstanding citizens toward racial progress. So there are 6 black men and 6 white men. I always joke that women had not yet been invented at this time, so they weren't able to find any to serve on the commission. And so this is, you know, these are not their opinions, but this is their honest assessment of the things that other people have put forth to solve, you know, the Negro problem.
But I think the most shocking part there is hope for a solution through the dying out of the Negro race. And again, it's not the people writing the report who are proposing this. They're looking at how people have dealt with it in the past or thought about it in the past, but it's a part of the past that they're still contending with in the present of the 1920s.
Right. And I think it's shocking to hear said explicitly, but I think one of the things about this text that resonates for the present moment is that, you know, I think that there are a lot of people that still think that. And I think that there are different ways in which it's become possible for that sentiment to evolve and morph in different ways and be said in ways that are more or less socially acceptable. But I think the basic sentiment is still there and undergirds a lot of the basic functioning of American society.
Your book of poems is written in dialogue with this report. So after hearing that paragraph, Countless Schemes, from the report, you have a poem called Countless Schemes. Would you read it for us?
I'd be happy to.
And you pair this poem with the passage that I read.
Yes. So every poem in the book begins with a passage from this archival text, which is my sneaky way of getting people to read an archival text, which, by the way, is available in its entirety in PDF widely on the internet. So folks who really want to can go read it. But yes, I'm going to read this poem. The title is Countless Schemes. 1. You don't have enough boats. We came here head to toe. And now we are millions, and now we demand to sit upright. And so you don't have enough boats. 2. You would give us the most wretched desert, not the desert of our fathers, where God is watching and manna comes down like the snow. You would give us all that is barren. You would give our children sand to eat. 3. We been had that. 4. You said, hope for a solution through the dying out of the Negro race. Hope for a solution through the dying out of the Negro. Hope for a solution through the dying out. You said, hope for the Negro dying. Hope through the dying. Hope for the dying out. The solution, dying. You said, dying. The Negro. The Negro dying. The Negro hope. Hope the Negro. You said, hope for dying. Hope dying. 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 You said hope.
So what precipitated the 1919 riot in Chicago?
the broader context is that during the Great Migration, thousands and thousands of Black people are coming north from the agricultural South, looking for work, trying to escape what was really a violent state and extrajudicial regime of punishment and oppression overseen by, you know, governments in the South, as well as the Klan, as well as just random lynch mobs. And so 50,000 Black people came to Chicago during this one decade. It was just a massive population growth in a really short period of time. And, you know, that was happening also in the context of this period right after World War One, when many Black veterans were returning. And so on the one hand, you have white people who are increasingly uncomfortable with the presence of new Black neighbors, keeping in mind that this is in a context of just massive American demographic change anyway, right? Like lots of Eastern European immigrants, lots of immigrants coming from other places. And yet the presence of Black people is seen as too great and indignant. The specific event that took place was that a teen boy named Eugene Williams was swimming on a hot summer day on July 27th, 1919. And Eugene was swimming in Lake Michigan, as we do. And in Chicago, we never had de jure segregation. So Chicago was never a Jim Crow city, but we've always had de facto segregation, meaning, you know, just by habit and by practice, our city is very segregated. And so on this particular day, Eugene was swimming in Lake Michigan, and he drifted over from what was unofficially the Black part of the beach and the water to the white part of the beach and the water. And what happened next, there's a few different disputing accounts. Either he looked onto the beach and saw that there was a group of white young people throwing rocks at Black people, and he became afraid and didn't want to get out of the water, and or he was actually hit in the head by a rock. But whatever happened, Eugene drowned. And people saw it happen. A group of Black people who witnessed it demanded that a police officer arrest some of the people throwing rocks. They refused to do that. And tensions escalated. A shot was fired by a man named James Crawford, who was then shot himself by the police. And that's how everything basically popped off thereafter.
You have a poem about Eugene Williams drowning.
Yes.
And dying. It's called Jump Rope, and it's written like a jump rope rhyme. Would you read it for us?
Like all the poems in the book, this begins with a quotation from the report, The Negro in Chicago. Here's the quotation. On Sunday, July 27th, 1919, there was a clash of white people and Negroes at a bathing beach in Chicago, which resulted in the drowning of a Negro boy. Jump, rope. Little Eugene, Gene, Gene. Sweetest I've seen. His mama told him, them white boys mean. He didn't listen to what mama say. Went to the lake that July day. No, it goes like, Little Eugene W, so sorry to trouble you. Rise, Eugene, rise. Calm your mama's cries. Just sit up and look around. Don't let them bury you down. No, it goes like, down, down, baby, down, down, the water's tugging. Sweet, sweet baby, don't make me let you go. Swallow, swallow, grab the sky. Swallow, swallow, dark. Swallow, swallow, grab the sky. Swallow, swallow, dark. Grandma, grandma, sick in bed. Call on Jesus, 'cause you're babies. No, it goes like, all dressed in black, black, black. All dressed in black, black, black. All dressed in. And he never came back, back, back.
Thank you, Eve. It's a beautiful poem. What inspired you to write it as a jump rope rhyme?
That's also hard for me to read. Number one, because it's very sad. Number two, because I'm not a singer and I have to sing this poem, so I always get really anxious about it. But, you know, I wrote it that way because I think about, you know, a lot of my work has to do with children and how we defend and celebrate the rights of children, and particularly the rights of Black children to be children. And I thought about Eugene and about the moments of terror he experienced in the last moments of his life and all the things that he will never do. And the thing about jump rope songs that amazes me is that somehow they're this piece of like childhood folk oral tradition where the same songs get passed, you know, from generation to generation in a world where a lot of other things have changed. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe in his time, Eugene heard or sang some of the same versions or, you know, different iterations of jump rope songs that maybe I sang and heard when I was a kid. So I thought about, you know, the jump rope song as a really a way of eulogizing him as a psalm. And then also, of course, you know, playing with the image of the rope as being one that is most readily associated with lynching. So this moment, what happens to Eugene is also a lynching, and the rope, the physical rope, is absent. So I'm kind of bringing in the specter of the rope here as well.
Tell us more about how the riot of 1919 and reading about what Black people from the South faced in the North after the Great Migration, how did that affect your reaction to the killing of George Floyd and the protests that followed?
First of all, one thing is that I have come to believe that it is really important to make space for mourning and for sadness and for grief. And this book is a grieving book. It's a mourning book. And I think that it was very hard for me to write. I've written 4 books. It was the hardest book of the 4. And I think I learned through that to make a lot of space for my sadness. And so one thing I think is important right now is for Black people everywhere, all people, but specifically Black people, to make space for our feelings, to make space for sadness, to pay attention to the ways in which fear and grief are shaping our everyday attempts to live and breathe and thrive on a daily basis. So that's something I've been trying to do, and that has been hard. I'm very sad a lot of the time, I'm very angry a lot of the time, and that's just something that is a reality of life. The other thing that I've learned is I, as a person, have very little faith in the sole power of information or even shocking information to change people's sentiments in a country in which our entire social fabric is predicated upon the dehumanization of Black people since the nation's inception. And the reason I say that is because if you read this 800 some page report, these were people that were really committed to gathering the right information. They interviewed lots of Black people. They did lots of surveys. They went door to door. They talked to people about the ways they experienced discrimination in the workplace and in housing and the fear that they felt. And they did their due diligence to tell people and to make it clear that this is not about failures of character, but about failures of a city to live up to its promises, failures of a country to live up to its promises. And so in recent days, I have been deeply moved and in moments encouraged by the ways in which people are rallying around the cause of protecting and cherishing Black life. But also, people have been really good information gatherers for a long time. People have done reporting and, you know, incredible, just stunning reporting and research and writing and documentation and storytelling to make it very clear for a long time exactly what's happening in America. And I worry that people really overestimate what we can accomplish just through that kind of storytelling and how deeply entrenched this hatred and contempt is in ways that we perhaps are still not fully contending with. And furthermore, the part that we are not talking about enough is that I'm always hesitant when I say that because, of course, there are always people having the right conversation, the good conversation. But what many people are not talking about enough is that there's the other side of it, which is that if Black people have been historically denied opportunities, jobs, resources, material wealth, if we've documented that, if we're now saying that that's not okay, that means that somebody else has to give something up. That means that we have to talk about wealth hoarding. We have to talk about the accrual of privilege. So that's the part of the conversation that I worry that we never quite get to. And things become really incendiary when we do.
Is what you're talking about a form of reparations? When you talk about the hoarding of wealth?
I'm absolutely talking about reparations, and I think that reparations can look a lot of different ways. I'm very proud as a Chicagoan of the reparations ordinance that was passed here for the victims of police torture. And something that's really inspiring about that ordinance, although it does not do nearly enough, because nothing can ever undo losing years of your life, or losing your life, or losing your dignity, or the trauma of being incarcerated wrongfully, or being incarcerated at all. But what inspires me about that ordinance is that it was not only about monetary reparations, but also thinking about how can we build new systems? How can we make sure that people in the communities affected by police torture have access to mental health resources? One of the things that was also required in the reparations ordinance here is that kids in Chicago public schools have to learn about the regime of police torture that happened here, and that's part of our history. So yes, I am absolutely 120% talking about material reparations, and I also think we need to think about what systems and structures we put into place to actually transform society and not only repair what is broken, but build something new and better.
Eve Ewing, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm overjoyed that I got to speak with you. Thanks, Terry.
Eve Ewing is a sociologist who teaches classes on race and education at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, where she's an assistant professor. Her books include Ghosts in the Schoolyard, Racism and School Closings on Chicago's South Side, and the collection of poems, 1919. On cable this month, Turner Classic Movies is presenting a series of movies with jazz connections. As it happens, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a new book about movies that tell jazz stories. Here's his defense of a much maligned film genre, the jazz biopic, screen biographies of jazz musicians.
All right, let's get to work. I got only one suggestion to make, Benny.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to be a band leader, you ought to change your name.
Why?
Who's going to remember a name like Benny Goodman?
A moment from the 1956 Benny Goodman story. He kept the name. Many jazz fans hate jazz biopics, biographical movies, and with good reason. Performers' lives get heavily compressed and fictionalized, and musicians who appear as themselves are made to say and do silly things. Personally, I like biopics, recognizing they're biographical fictions, not documentaries. I like seeing what true stuff gets in or gets left out, what gets invented when the true story would do, and how messy lives get squeezed into stock story formulas. And yet, it's surprising how much most biopics get right, if only because facts can be squeezed into dialogue when the action veers off course. In the Benny Goodman story, his booking agent's terse updates keep us apprised of the bandleader's early breakthroughs.
Hey, talk about busy fellas, you're going to be one, Benny. Deal is closed for the Congress Hotel. It looks like you're booked solid with one-night stands all the way from here to Chicago.
How about New York?
Oh, there's some interest there, too.
In the more ambitious biopics, invented scenes aim to reveal some higher truth. In 2016's Born to be Blue, after a beatdown leaves Chet Baker unable to play trumpet, Ethan Hawke's Chet retreats to his parents' farm in Oklahoma to recuperate in coldly beautiful wintertime. This poetic interlude speaks to Chet Baker's Oklahoma roots, but his parents had left there when he was 10. They'd been living in Redondo Beach. Some biopics go big. As the director and star of another one from 2016 put it,
if you're gonna tell a story, come with some attitude, man. Don't be all corny with this.
That's Don Cheadle channeling Miles Davis and declaring his intentions as the director of Miles Ahead. Many Miles fans hated that biopic for focusing on the trumpeter's druggy, reclusive years of the 1970s. But there are extended flashbacks to his earlier prime when Natty Miles plays ballads as love letters to his woman. The split narrative underscores the sweet and sour sides of his personality. Radical shifts in tone, plus a frame story, and a final scene where Cheadle's Miles jams with a pan-generational dream band all speak to Miles Davis's compulsion to keep reinventing himself. Most jazz biopics give you a sense of the artist's music via historical recordings or newly recorded solos by a living subject or through skillful mimicry. One reason I don't like Lady Sings the Blues is Diana Ross barely gives you a clue what the real Billie Holiday sounded like. Even in the ridiculous Danny Kaye biopic of cornetist Red Nichols, The Five Pennies, you hear the real Nichols when the character picks up the horn. And the real Red gets to trade licks with guest star Louis Armstrong. In The Five Pennies, disciplined studio pro Red Nichols turns into leering, compulsive entertainer Danny Kaye. It's not the only 50s biopic where the subject morphs into the actor. In St. Louis Blues, staid composer W.C. Handy becomes a suave, singing pianist very like star Nat King Cole. In the Gene Krupa story, the drummer smokes pot, has trouble dealing with early success, and makes the gossip columns with his self-indulgent antics, like the film star, Sal Mineo.
That stuff not only threw my timing off, but it made my sticks kind of slippery and... All right, so if there's a rap for having messed with this stuff once, I guess I got it coming to me. But those reefers were not mine!
Starting in the 1980s, with Bird about Charlie Parker, jazz biopics got more loose and creative, scrambling chronological order. We also start seeing jazz tales with unreliable narrators. The title of a 1991 biopic is a tell, Bix, an interpretation of a legend. The mostly kinda accurate story of doomed cornetist Bix Beiderbecke is told in flashback by violinist Joe Venuti. In the real world, Venuti was a notorious practical joker, so the made-up stuff might all be his invention, leaving the filmmakers with clean hands. In 2019's Bolden, jazz pioneer Buddy Bolden wastes away in a mental hospital trying to piece together his long-ago career and inserting fanciful details, just as other folks spread tall tales about the real Buddy. Bolden freely mixes man and myth, like movies about, say, Wyatt Earp. In fact, classic westerns make a good parallel with jazz biopics. Melodramas and morality tales set in an imagined past where the facts are twisted as needed, but with better music.
Kevin Whitehead's new book is called Play the Way You Feel: The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. Race became a central issue in my guest Kristen Howerton's life when she adopted two black children. Howerton is white. She decided to adopt after several miscarriages. First, she adopted a six-month-old who was in foster care, and later she adopted an infant from an orphanage in Haiti, but by the time the adoption went through, he was 3 years old. After being told she would never be able to have biological children, she gave birth to two daughters. Her new book, Rage Against the Minivan, which is also the name of the blog she created several years ago, is about miscarriage, birth, adoption, being the daughter of a pastor, and then the wife of a pastor, and then leaving the church. And it's about race and what she learned about white privilege. Howerton is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She co-hosts the podcast Selfie. Kristen Howerton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me.
On Twitter, you describe yourself as a skilled catastrophizer. Now that we're actually living with multiple catastrophes, the pandemic, police killings of young black men, economic disaster, how you doing?
Well, I was joking with another friend who's also a skilled catastrophizer, and we were saying, you know, we've sort of been living for this. Like, we've been we've been assuming that something terrible was lurking around the corner our entire lives. And, you know, once the pandemic happened, it's like, here we go, here we go. And then in terms of, you know, everything that's happening with the race conversation nationally, I mean, I definitely feel like I have been waiting for that to happen too. As a mom of two black kids and someone who has just been desperate for America to kind of grapple with these issues that are very apparent to us, it does feel like we've been waiting for this conversation to happen.
So let's talk about race. You have two biological white children and two adopted mm-hmm. black children. Let's talk about what you've learned as the mother of two white and two black children. Let's start with the adoption. You adopted your first son after having several miscarriages and being told you'd never be able to carry to term. So how did you decide to adopt a black baby from foster care?
Well, I knew that black children were overrepresented in foster care. And I also knew that black children were more likely to wait for parents. In fact, when we signed up and did our foster care classes, we were told that we were one of the few couples who were open to black children. Because, you know, when you go to adopt, you are given this checklist. And it's a checklist that no parent who gets pregnant has to fill out. And you have to answer these very difficult questions about what kind of child you're open to. You know, are you open to a medical condition? Are you open to physical deformities? And, you know, it's a list that you feel like it's kind of a test of your humanity. You know, like, how good of a person am I if I am not open to a heart condition? But one of the questions on that questionnaire is race. And we were open to any race. And, you know, we were told, well, it will be likely then that you're placed with a black child because we don't have as many families who have checked that box. And I was open to that. I have nephews who are black. You know, I felt at the time like I was well prepared to raise a black child. Now, I would later learn that I was very naive and clueless. But at the time, I felt like, you know, we can do this. And, you know, I think we can raise a black child and make sure that, you know, they are experiencing their culture. But I had a steep learning curve ahead of me.
You know, you're right. At first, having a black son was like a badge of pride, a badge of courage, proof that you were a kind and caring person and definitely not a racist, proof that you loved all of God's children. Can you elaborate on that for us, how it made you feel at first to have a black son?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I have to say that it's really cringy to talk about some of those feelings, but I put them in the book because I wanted to be really honest. I wanted to be really honest about some of the mentality that I had going in, because I think it's a journey of becoming aware of my own race that a lot of white people have to be on, because I'd never been super aware of my own race. I think that's what we do as white people. We just kind of think we're default. You know, we think that other people have a racial identity and that we are just kind of like this voidless default, or even worse, normal. So, you know, when I adopted my first son, I felt very conspicuous all of a sudden, because I'm walking around with a black child. And it wasn't that I was embarrassed. It was more that I felt like, well, you know, look, we're showing the world that love is all you need. We're showing the world that a family could look like two different races. And I just did have this naive thought that transracial adoption would be one way of fighting racism, that if we as a family could show love across racial lines, that that would somehow be like a beacon of hope for racism. And I think that that's a very misguided way of thinking, but I think it was there for me.
But eventually, having a black son made you realize the optics of your own race for the first time and your understanding of white privilege. How did it help you understand what white privilege means?
Well, first of all, I think I had to come to terms with white is a culture and a race, you know, that whiteness has its own set of values, of behaviors, of cultural norms, you know, that we are not just a default. And, you know, I even think of how we use the term ethnic, and we use the term ethnic to describe something that's not white, right? Ethnic food means it's a food from another country. And I think I had to come to terms with the idea that, like, whiteness is its own ethnicity and culture. And I had to figure out what that looked like for myself. And then I had to recognize in the middle of that how many privileges I had as a result of being white. And those privileges could look like something small, like the fact that I can walk into a Target and know they're going to have a shampoo that works for my hair. But when my kids were younger, now this has changed quite a bit over the years, but when my kids were younger, I didn't know if I walked into a store if they would have a section for black hair. Or it looked, you know, and these are benign examples. It could look like I could find a Band-Aid that matched the skin tone of my white kids, but not my black kids. But then there are much more troubling aspects of that white privilege, which is that I can reasonably assume that if I get pulled over, I won't be yanked out of the car and placed on the ground, even if I got mouthy, or that I can reasonably assume that I'm not going to be shadowed and followed in a store and thought of as maybe someone who's going to steal something. And, you know, as my kids have grown, and I have two white children and two black children, the disparity in the way that the world sees them and perceives them has become very obvious to me.
You describe an incident where you were hearing noises in your backyard and you were afraid it was an intruder. You called the police, but then you started to worry, what if the police officer saw your son, one of your sons, and thought he was an intruder because he was black and you're white? Can you run through what your nightmare scenario was there?
To be honest, the worst part of that is that I actually didn't predict that. I didn't have that fear until it was too late. And this would be another example of me sort of being confronted with my own privilege, is I called the police, as one does. I heard something crash in the backyard. I thought maybe there was someone back there. Instinctively called the cops, thought nothing else. The cops show up. My kids are still asleep. They weren't woken up by the noise. And the cops go into the backyard. And then they decide they want to come into the house. And they come into the house with guns drawn. And my son hears this, bolts out of bed, and runs to my bedroom. And I just had that realization of, if these cops had been in the hallway at that time, which thankfully they weren't, they were in the living room, but if they'd been in the hallway at that time with their guns drawn looking for an intruder and watched a black preteen who was as tall as them run down the hallway in a house where maybe they weren't expecting to see a black male, that could have ended very badly. And for me, that was a real scary lesson in thinking through how I interact with the police with two black sons. You know, that first of all, maybe I shouldn't have called the police. But second of all, if I was in a situation where it really felt necessary, that I should have described the makeup of my family to the dispatcher. And then again, when they arrived, like I should have, that should have been top of mind. There are two black children in this house, so that everyone was on the same page of what to expect. But I didn't do that. That was a blind spot for me.
When you adopted your second son, you wanted to make sure that the son was black so that your first son would have somebody who looked like him in the family, because you're in a white majority neighborhood and you and your husband, your now ex-husband, are white. So was that helpful to your older son to have a brother who was also black?
I think it's been invaluable. And I just instinctively felt that. I mean, I knew when I adopted my first child that I would need to give him a racially matched sibling some way. In fact, when I first signed up to adopt from foster care, on that list that I described before, where you're answering all these difficult questions, one of the questions is, how many children are you willing to take? And I'd been willing to take a sibling set up to 3. So, you know, I kind of thought even at the beginning, like, maybe I'll just adopt siblings and then they'll all, you know, then they'll all have each other. But we ended up being matched with one child. But I felt really strongly, I want to give him a mirror. You know, I want to give him another person in the family who he shares this experience with. And I think it has made a huge difference. They're very close. And, you know, they can talk about being adopted. They can talk about race. They can have that shared experience. But I felt, I remember, because the adoption of my second son, we thought that it would take about a year. And we were matched with him when he was 6 months old. And he ended up not coming home until he was 3.5. So by that point, his older brother, Jafta, was 5. And so he lived with us till he was 5, being the only Black member of our family. And I remember it killed me. Because we were trying, but the adoption was just taking a long time. And it just killed me that he was the only Black member of our family. And he would say things about that. You know, he would say, I don't match anyone else. Or, you know, because by then I had had my biological children too, kind of in the middle of all of that. And he would say, you know, I don't look like my siblings, or you all match and I don't. And I found that really heartbreaking. So I was really glad to be able to give him a sibling that he can relate to in that way.
What kinds of discussions have you been having in your home about race and about the police since the police killing of George Floyd?
Our conversations haven't changed on that as much because we were already having them. And I think that's probably true for most families with Black children. It almost is like we're watching the world catch up with what we already knew to be true, which is that there is intense bias against Black men and intense violence at the hands of police officers. Not every police officer, but very disproportionately. And so we have had those conversations since the boys were much younger, of just, what do you do when you're pulled over? And how do you interact with police officers? And what do you do if you feel you're being accused of something you didn't do? And the thing that our conversations always lead back to is, coming home safe is the priority. That's the priority. And that has to be top of mind in those situations and any interaction with law enforcement. It's confusing because in life in general, most parents are giving kids messages of, stand up for yourself and be bold and be assertive. But for parents of Black children, we then have to say, but, right? Like, but in these situations, don't be bold, don't be assertive, be compliant, you know, listen to instruction. If you're being accused of something that you didn't do, just be kind. It's a tough balancing act of wanting our kids to be able to be who they are and be themselves, but at the same time, wanting to protect them in these interactions.
Have you had friends or even strangers, white people, who are overeager and trying to be allies with you in your decision to adopt Black children and to have a multiracial family?
Where I've really noticed the overeagerness is friends or teachers really wanting me to understand that their kids don't see race, or that other kids don't see race. And so an example of that is, I can't even tell you how many times a parent has told me, like, oh, you know, Sally was just talking about, you know, your kids, and like, she didn't even notice that they were a different race. Or she, you know, a lot of parents want to talk to me about like how their kid doesn't notice, as if that is, you know, some proof that racism is over. And, you know, that's always a little bit frustrating, because I think kids do notice color. They may not understand genetics, or they may not, you know, they may not understand race as a construct. But they certainly understand color, and they will certainly understand inequity as they grow up. So I think that's the way that I see that manifest. Or teachers, you know, me telling a story and saying, you know, I think that, you know, this topic is a little awkward for my son because he's the only Black student in the room. And how are you going to deal with that? And then a teacher saying like, well, you know, none of the kids notice that, or racism has to be taught. I hear that one a lot too, which I think is, you know, I don't know if that's true anymore. I actually think that kids can, you know, can be xenophobic just on their own. They can exclude kids that aren't the same gender. They can exclude kids who wear glasses. They can exclude kids who aren't the same race. And it doesn't mean their parents are racists or glasses haters. It's just that kids exclude. That's a thing that they do. And I think I've just seen a lot of people try to deny that that can happen.
Does the expression colorblind take on new meaning for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was raised by parents, as many people were, who were proponents of this idea of colorblindness because maybe their parents were actively racist. And so this was an overcorrection of like, well, we're not going to talk about race. We don't even see race. Like, it doesn't matter what color someone is. And I think there's a well-meaning intent behind it, but it's also very hurtful because if we're perpetuating the idea of colorblindness, then first of all, we're not seeing the fullness of other people and their experience. But then second, it gives us an opportunity to deny real experiences of racism and to deny that people of color are having a very different experience in the world than we are. So I think colorblindness is very misguided.
Kristen Howerton, thank you so much for talking with us. And, you know, be well. And I hope your family stays well.
Thank you.
Kristen Howerton's new memoir is called Rage Against the Minivan.